I'm Gail Harris, and for Dick Gordon, this is The Connection. Anyone looking for an example of government's good intentions gone awry might easily start with public housing. What began in the 1930s as a determined effort to clear out city slums and tenements, later turned into a way station for veterans newly back from the war, and then finally a dumping ground for the poorest of the poor. Now, even its most ardent supporters are debating whether ultimately public housing should be a place to live or a place to leave. Others are torn between eliminating it or turning it into something else. The latest experiment in public housing has been development where people with different incomes live side by side. But the Bush administration has recently decided that's a bad idea, too. Meanwhile, as the debate goes on, low-cost housing for those least able to pay for it is disappearing. City by city, town by town, unit by unit. Connection listeners, what is the place of the poor in America's cities? Can public housing be reclaimed? And should it? And what does the state of public housing say about the way America views its poor? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And with me this hour is MIT Professor Lawrence Vail, who has been studying the unintended consequences of public housing policy for decades. His new book, A Case Study of Three Projects in Boston, is called Reclaiming Public Housing, A Half Century of Struggle in Three Public Neighborhoods. Welcome, Larry.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Well, it's nice to have you with us. You know, the history of public housing is absolutely fascinating, and I think it's part of the story that many of us really have no idea of, because when you look at many housing projects today, it almost seems hard to believe that at one time people were clamoring to get in there. In fact, in places like Boston, you had to have political pull to even be considered.
There wasn't a college in the city of Boston or anywhere in the country that was more selective than public housing was in the late 1930s. The first project in Boston had more than 10,000 applications for 1,000 apartments, and the people who got in really had to treat it as a great reward that they had the proper family composition, the proper citizenship, the proper housekeeping habits, the proper stable job, all of the kind of good housekeeping seal of approval that made them so desirable as tenants. This was the nature of the demand that was once there for public housing in this city and many others.
As you say, harder to get into public housing at one time than to get into Harvard University,
yep.
Which seems amazing. One of the projects that you studied in Boston had 12 baseball teams, its own symphony, its own newspaper, its own credit union. I mean, it sounds as if at one time these were not only viable communities, but actually quite vibrant ones.
They were vibrant because they were designed to be so. They were really put out as the alternative to the sorts of slum conditions that were seen as all around them, and in many cases the sorts of places that were being torn down to be replaced with public housing. And by bringing together all of these people, I don't know that they were actually recruiting for violists or any such thing, there was a sense that these were people on their way up who'd been temporarily waylaid by the Depression. But if they had a decent and stable place to live for a few years, they might go on, as many did, to buy their own homes, often moving to the suburbs directly. This was an upwardly mobile working class that was targeted for public housing, not the least advantaged. Many of those people were the ones displaced to build it.
And yet when you say the words public housing to those of us who came to age in the 60s and in the 70s, these were places who were, I'm reminded of the uncharted areas of medieval maps. You know, beyond here lie dragons. There was the place that you knew, and then there was the place, public housing, where it was uncharted. You didn't want to go in there by yourself.
I think that's the perfect metaphor is the wrong side of the tracks, and we had it with public housing to the point where in Boston the Kennedy Library has all of its public rooms facing all of the different views except for the direction of the Columbia Point housing project that was on one side that we just tried to look away from as a society and only recently have come to deal with in any serious way as the various attempts to rebuild and reclaim these places have taken effect.
Well, actually, Columbia Point is a perfect example of a place that was put kind of out in the middle of nowhere not a lot of support systems around it, not good access to transportation, no churches, no supermarkets. I assume that having that kind of infrastructure around a place makes a difference in whether it's going to be a good place to live or not.
Well, I think that certainly affected the long-term outcome of Columbia Point, especially given that it was housing poor people who tended not to own automobiles and tended to be in a place where those kinds of conveniences were needed. On the other hand, there are many places that were built on these slum clearance properties in the center of cities where there were all sorts of things within walking distance, and those places declined as well in many of America's larger cities.
You actually grew up living fairly close to the, I guess I can safely say, infamous Cabrini Green development. What was it about Cabrini Green that made it such a tough place to live and almost to the point where it has assumed mythic proportions in how we think about public housing?
I think it was a sense of the uncertainty, a sense of the violence that legitimately did happen at that place that made it a place where I, as a child, was told to avoid. The closest I came was a nursery school that was about two or three blocks away from it, but I was a little young to know that. But for most of my childhood in the 60s and 70s, our family simply refused to drive down the streets that went in Cabrini Green, and always regarded it as this kind of zone that had to be bypassed if you were going to get safely anywhere.
And yet it must have, those were high rises, right? So they were sort of a looming presence, I would imagine, over your neighborhood.
They were quite a looming presence. There are also, the first part of Cabrini Green was actually townhouses that are likely to survive even the most recent drastic plans to overhaul Cabrini. And those perhaps have provided better housing over the years than the infamous reds and whites, as the two kinds of high-rises were known, with the street called Division running between them. One of the great ironies that a street prefigured some of the same kinds of problems that the buildings housed.
Let's talk for a moment about some of the architecture and the design of these places, because there was a dreary sameness to many of them. I mean, you could tell at a glance what they were. Flat roofs, for example. What were some of the other architectural issues?
Well, the initial architectural issue was to try and distinguish them as much as possible from the kinds of dwellings that were located just outside the boundaries of public housing. Not as a way of stigmatizing the public housing, but as a way of revealing the new and modern and spacious and open qualities that the alternative and progressive nature of architecture could bring to the lives of low-income people.
In other words, this is a good thing. Look at this. This is brand new. This is different looking.
It was different and better was the intent, and legitimately so in many cases. In many places, the places that were replaced by public housing were cold water flats. They might have had a pitched roof on the top of a townhouse, but they were rickety wooden structures with, in some cases, outdoor bathrooms, no such thing as central heating or any of the kinds of modern appliances that came with public housing. To move into public housing in the late 30s and 40s and even early 50s was a move directly into modernity, not just in architectural terms, but in terms of simple functionality in a kitchen or in a bathroom. For many people, this was an enormous opportunity to have a wholly different lifestyle than had been possible. At least that was the way the rhetoric went. Many of the people who were in such awful places were never able to move into public housing because they found that the public housing that was built had rents that were about 50% higher than what they had been paying for their substandard housing, even if they could pass muster on all of the more moral judgments that were being placed about their family structure.
And then there was the next group that came in, the veterans who lived in public housing, came home from the war. But federal policy made it easy for them, as you were mentioning a moment ago, to kind of move up and out, to get out to the suburbs. There were low-interest mortgages that were made available to them. Was there anything wrong with that, or was this simply a good policy that happened to have unforeseen side effects for the people who were left behind?
I don't think anybody would quarrel with the sorts of good things that were done for veterans after the Second World War or any time before or since. The thing that may be worth mentioning is that these were disproportionately benefits that went to white people in the society, and that increasingly the waiting list for public housing city by city became non-white, in part because whites had so many more housing opportunities, whether made affordable by the government or made tenable by the sheer willingness of landlords to house them. Those kinds of questions. It's impossible to have a discussion of public housing without very quickly moving into the question of race.
Speaking of which, I was going to ask you to help us advance on the timeline now from the time when the veterans were the predominant population there. And then sometime, what, in the 60s, it became viewed as the dumping ground?
Well, I think I don't know that dumping ground is the fair thing. I prefer a term like coping mechanism, that there's a sense of what is the societal obligation to the least advantaged, and what happens when the people who are applying for public housing are needier than any of the people that ever applied in the beginning. What tends to happen is that a lot of the people that were thought to be such great and desirable tenants that applied in droves in the 40s and 50s simply ceased to apply. They had other alternatives in various places, and they chose to exercise those opportunities. On the other hand, the civil rights movement, certainly by the mid-60s, was saying, wait a minute, you can't have public housing developments that are reserved only for the people of one race. You can't have public housing developments that discriminate against single-parent households and parents with children out of wedlock. Those kinds of things that were happening on a regular basis in a city like Boston, which was still clinging to the desirability of public housing into the 1960s, simply made it very, very difficult for anyone who wanted to be going into it. Whereas by the 1960s, the Boston Housing Authority, under a reform administrator, said, we really have to start behaving in accordance with the laws of the land. We can't segregate our housing. We can't discriminate against these kind of people. And there was a statement that was issued in 1965 that effectively said, we have a moral obligation to house the people that the private sector cannot or will not house. That's just a far cry from where we had been 30 years before when public housing was getting started. It goes back to a much deeper rooted sense that the society must somehow, through its governance, take care of those who cannot sustain themselves economically. And we return to that. It had the effect of making people much less able to afford public housing and to be in public housing in a way that may seem to be a housing of last resort.
All right, we'll continue the conversation in just a moment. We're talking about public housing this hour with Lawrence Vail, professor of urban studies and planning at MIT. Connection listeners, can public housing be reclaimed, and should it? And what does the state of public housing say about the way America views its poor? 1-800-423-8255 is our number. I'm Gail Harris, and for Dick Gordon, this is The Connection from NPR. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. We're talking about public housing this hour. Joining me is Lawrence Vail, professor of urban design and planning at MIT. He has been studying public housing for more than two decades now, and his new book is Reclaiming Public Housing, A Half Century of Struggle in Three Public Neighborhoods. Connection listeners, what is the place of the poor in America's cities? Can public housing be reclaimed? Should it? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And in thinking about those two decades that you've been studying public housing, I have to remember that 20 years ago I was doing a series on public housing for public television. And at that time, it really was a mess. Is it still, or is it better now?
Well, I think you have to distinguish among large city public housing and the 3,500 public housing authorities around the country, many of which are in perfectly good shape in smaller communities. And many of the big city ones are still in pretty good shape. It's the real problem cases that we hear most about. You can't go too far without hearing something about the Chicago public housing and the ambitious plans to demolish and rebuild in that city. On the other hand, if you looked at a city like Boston in the late 1970s, it was arguably the worst in the country, the first public housing authority to put into court-ordered receivership in 1980. And since then, it has come back a long way and certainly is one of the better, or at least well above average, among the larger housing authorities in the country. So it's something that varies city by city, neighborhood by neighborhood, decade by decade, and seems to resist transformations of any kind of wholesale character.
I have to wonder if early on the government had made it possible for people to buy their units at a very low cost in the same way that these low-interest mortgages were made available to the veterans. Would that have made a difference if people had had some feeling of ownership about where they were, that they could individualize their units, that they had some choice about where they were living?
The question is when someone would have done that, because if you'd done it at the beginning, many of the people there would have simply bought them and we'd be left without public housing, and they would have never reached the lowest incomes of the people in most American cities. The track record on doing that kind of sales to residents, which was done very widely in Britain starting in the Thatcher years, especially during the 1980s, tended to be that the largest sales went to the most desirable properties, the ones that were single-family houses already, and the hardest ones to sell were the larger flats in large buildings. We tried to do that a bit in this country, but it never worked terribly well. It was one of the initial programs of the first Bush administration and the origin of the acronym HOPE, Home Ownership and Opportunity for People Everywhere. We still have programs now that use that acronym, but the original idea was to try and sell off as much of different kinds of things and to do exactly what you say. The question is whether you can achieve some of the kind of ownership sense in a more psychological way, that people feel like it's their place, even if they don't actually own it, because they feel in control of their world. And sometimes that can be done the redevelopment if it's well designed and well managed.
One of the quotes I was very struck with from the book was from one of the tenants, which was, "They call it public housing because they let anyone live here."
Yeah, that's a sad commentary of what had happened. And it reminds me of two things. One, that there was a sense of just open to all comers, and that people could, even without being residents of public housing, use public housing as a zone to do kinds of misbehaviors that they wouldn't think about doing in other parts of the city.
For example?
Use it as a place to dump their trash, for instance, on the street, or to go throw something through a window, that kind of thing. It isn't always the tenants themselves. The other thing that's so striking about that quote is that it is almost always the residents themselves who are hardest on other residents. The hierarchy of people feeling like they are a good and deserving and hardworking person living in public housing who has no business being stigmatized by what the place has become, and the people who are creating the problems, is very acutely felt by the people who live in this place. And that's really been so striking to me, that the first people to complain about the behavior of public housing residents are other public housing residents who are very well behaved.
Let's go to our phone lines and see what some of our listeners have to say. First to Lafayette, Louisiana. Hello, Mary.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Well, just listening to the station, I was struck by the fact that in our area, there are second and third generation folks in public housing here. I mean, in one family, you know, these people have grown up there. Their mom was there. Their grandmom was there. And they just, there's no opportunity really for these folks to get out. They're all on public benefits in one way or another. I say all, but, and a lot of them don't have a chance to go to school. There's not enough child care for them to get into GED programs. If they completed a GED program, is that enough anyway? We've just got families who've been intergenerational in the same housing unit, and we don't have enough programs to get these folks self-sufficient.
All right. Thanks for the call, Mary. What about that, Larry? Because it brings us back to the central question of, is this a place to live or a place to leave?
That's right. And the ideal community ought to be some of each. You want to have a stable cohort of people in there for the long haul who take a real interest in the long-term future of the place, but you also want to have it possible to leave. One of the problems is that the people who are trapped in public housing tend to be those with some form of disability or lack of education or lack of the kind of opportunities for advancement that the caller describes. And it does become a form of entrapment. I don't think it's the rule. I think we tend to stereotype the multi-generational household in public housing when if you actually look at the numbers, the turnover still remains fairly high, and that's a more exceptional kind of case. But it's a mark of the failure of our society to provide the kinds of opportunities, whether it be daycare or educational, that will enable people in one generation to be able to move onward and forward. On the other hand, sometimes there is an advantage for things like that to have a multi-generational household. The daycare person may well be that grandmother who is nearby, and that there are things facilitated by having an extended family in terms of social and sometimes economic health, and that we wouldn't discourage families from staying together in private housing, so I'm not sure that we should always discourage it in public housing. But I certainly take the point that facilitating upward mobility with other kinds of programs is a very good idea and ought to be done more in public housing.
Thanks so much for the call, Mary. So how does that play out in the debate now? Because one of the ways in which it was thought to deal with this was, well, we'll get mixed income developments. We will bring in people who have more income to live among the poor people. They will provide good role models and so on.
Well, it's an interesting thing. If you go back to what I said earlier, that the origins of public housing are as a kind of reward for good behavior and good citizenship, then it becomes more of a coping mechanism for the least advantaged. Now the challenge among policymakers is to try and shift it back as much as possible to that first model, to regard public housing as a privilege, and to say that if there's been a massive redevelopment of one of these places that sometimes costs in the hundreds of millions of dollars, that it ought to have a different group of people living in it, and that further, it's for the good of the lowest income peoples to have this kind of mixture of incomes. I have real questions about this. The role model of someone who has a very high-paying job and is a market-rate paying person may not be a good role model it may not be any better role model than the person who simply has a low-income job but goes to it every day and is more likely to relate to the sorts of people in public housing who often are working, but working at very low-paying jobs.
And in fact, is there any evidence that these people are mixing together? I mean, are they all having block parties in these developments, or are the market-income people staying to themselves and the people on disability and so on staying to themselves?
I don't think anyone has yet done the kind of serious ethnographic study of what it means to live in one of these communities in these dimensions. It's simply been assumed that it must be a good idea. It's assumed because it's economically appealing to have this kind of influx of money into the development. It's politically appealing because it's seen as serving a much broader constituency. But whether it is socially necessary is just not clear to me. And one of the places that I've studied most closely over the last 15 to 20 years is the Commonwealth development in Boston in the Brighton section, where the redevelopment has occurred dramatically and successfully from a 50% vacant hellhole 20 years ago into one of the most vibrant and safe and secure communities, and it's done that without income mixing. And so I keep asking to those who are making policy, why isn't the example of Boston's Commonwealth development the national model you look at? Why is it that we are spending so much of our public money to tear down public housing, and then when we rebuild it, to put so few very low-income people in it at a time when millions of people are unable to find affordable housing, especially those, and disproportionately those, who have the lowest incomes? How can we justify tearing down this scarce resource? Can we really do that on an untested sociological theory?
Well, as you say, like so many of these ideas, seemed like a good idea at the time. Let's go to our phone lines again to Charleston, South Carolina, where Lila's on the line. Hi, Lila.
Hi. I'm very interested in your conversation. We have a very complicated relationship with modern architecture here in Charleston, and the public housing has reflected that. I mean, they've gone to a great deal of trouble recently to, and even in the older public housing, is much more like a kind of little village and smaller houses, and some of that had been torn down. But I was curious because you know, so much of modern architecture has gotten this kind of rap for the bad life that goes on in it, and your description of the history of the selection process was very enlightening to me. I hadn't understood that that was the case, that there had been a point when they decided they really must admit people regardless of, you know, their cultures in a sense, in their lives, and that really has had an effect. And so I'm just curious as to your take on whether you know, how much of a culprit the architecture is, whether you've aware of how they're doing it here in this city. They've been making little houses to fit in with the neighborhoods and, you know, really, really trying very hard to architecturally make the housing be something that is more like everybody else's housing in this part of the world.
Thanks, Lila. Appreciate the phone call. We talked a little bit about architecture at the beginning, and I'm also struck with one of the stories that you tell in the book about how, as the Commonwealth Project was in the process of being managed privately by a private management company, one of the first things they did was come in and plant flowers, and people were just astonished at that. Nobody had ever thought to do that before. So it's really, what, architecture plus?
It's a question of respect. Fundamentally, whether it's respect for the neighborhood traditions architecturally and trying to fit in that way, or it's a question of respecting the tenants who are going to live there. I haven't my visits to Charleston have been where the tourists are supposed to go, not the public housing. But I think the general question of how do you build public housing that engages with the traditions of the place were something that happened a lot in the 1940s and 50s when the earliest public housing was built. There was a sense that this was about being for the good people of that place and really trying to be as unalien as possible. Then we went to a point where it was really how do we get as many of these apartments built as economically as possible to separate out people that we can't cope with as an urban system. And now we're trying, whether it be through the scattering of smaller developments or the rehabilitation into much more traditional-looking kinds of communities, to rethink that neighborhood connection and to really try and minimize the distance aesthetically and socially from the surrounding kind of community, to make public housing appealing to those who don't live in it, so that it won't be so politically stigmatized.
And yet, when the mixed income developments happen, or when the rehab efforts come in to lower the density, you're still losing about 40% of the units that once were available to the people who needed them most. So either way, you're losing units.
You're losing units. The good way to lose units is to recognize that our standards of living are so much higher than they were a half century ago, and that the expectations that people have for how much space they'll have in various rooms and in an apartment have greatly increased. And so it's understandable that that people will want to have larger apartments. And if you have the same amount of floor area, that means fewer total. On the other hand, what has happened under the dominant federal program of the last decade, the so-called HOPE 6 program, which is one of those programs that emerged from the acronym I mentioned a while ago, home ownership and opportunity for people everywhere. It isn't been for people everywhere. I often think that they should rename the program Housing Our Poor People Elsewhere. That's really a more accurate definition of what's been happening under the HOPE 6 program. It's certainly hopeful in a lot of ways, but how hopeful is it when the federal government tells us that only 11% of the people who've been displaced from these developments for the rebuilding since 1992 are getting or likely to get homes in the ones that are built to replace their dwellings. What's really happening is that the people who live in these places are being shunted into other public housing vacancies or given vouchers to get housing on the private market. And very few of the people who have suffered through the worst conditions are actually getting to enjoy the fruits of the redevelopment and to live in these places that look like the kinds of communities that you or I or anyone in the country would be happy to live in.
Connection listeners, we're talking about public housing this hour, its past, its present, and its future. What is the place for the poor in America's cities? And what does the state of public housing say about the way America views its poorest citizens? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. We're talking this hour about public housing with MIT Professor Lawrence Vail. His new book is Reclaiming Public Housing, A Half Century of Struggle in Three Public Neighborhoods. You can join in the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And let's check in with Corinne, who's calling in from Wisconsin from Richland Center. Hi, Corinne.
Hi there. I'm glad this program is on today because I have been flirting with architecture where I live, and this is a hometown of Frank Lloyd Wright. I wish he would have designed this place. You won't believe how bad it is here. This apartment house is about 30 years old, I believe, and I have no basement. I have no upstairs to go to in case of a tornado or anything else.
So you're in public housing, Corinne?
Yes, exactly. Okay. I've been here going on 8 years now. But so far, I've had sexual harassment from the management, told I could sue him. He is just very nasty. I thought there was some rules that when they let people in these places, they can't have a history of felonies and things like that. But I've had theft and threats and everything else, foul language. It's just terrible. I'm a senior citizen, 68, and handicapped. And I'm trying to get out of here, and I don't know where and why and what I can do. The way they designed this place, of when you brought up architecture, I like that, because I'm sitting on a flat. I have two bedrooms, which is a spare bedroom. But if they want to get at my furnace, my water heater, and my water softener, they have to go through my back bedroom, which they could have had by the back door here. It would have been simple to do it, but I guess, I don't know who designed it, but Mr. Wright. But the walls are cracking here. I've had water seepage underneath here that went for 3 months. They wouldn't look at it. And somebody needs to look into HUD housing. I've complained to the Wisconsin politicians in Washington and Madison, and they won't do a thing.
All right. Thanks for the call, Corinne. Let's pose the question to Larry. Anything Corinne can do? Any recourse that she has other than complaining? It doesn't seem to be doing much good.
It certainly sounds like she's done all the things that could be done, and some of it may be that it was Frank Lloyd Wrong that designed it, but it could also be really a failure of the maintenance and the management and the money to be able to keep up with some of what's needed for a building that has been around a while. A lot of housing authorities, it's not to defend them, but have been faced with tremendous cutbacks and really haven't had the capacity to invest in their properties the way they should. And there really isn't much more to do other than to work with other tenant organizations to try and find some kind of recourse. I've found that in many cities, when there are many tenants complaining in an organized fashion, that sometimes is what gets real results, especially when they start to partner with attorneys.
Well, isn't one of the problems here traditionally that very often the people who are in public housing do not represent a powerful political constituency, and so it is easier to ignore them than it is to pay attention to them?
That may be true, but the stories that I report in my book are really about very much the empowerment of tenant communities. And at the heart of what made for a successful redevelopment in Boston, and I think in many other places, was the willingness of tenants to really make this almost a full-time job, trying to reform their housing environment and to make noise and make connections right up to the legislature of the state and through their local representatives. And it sometimes, in the best cases, makes a great deal of difference.
All right, let's take a call now from Somerville, Massachusetts. Jay's on the line. Hi, Jay.
Hi, Gail. Well, I'm amazed at this program because I've been a cable guy now for the past 5 years in the greater Boston area, and I see things that people would not imagine existed in what I've heard from the show is a very evolved public housing system over the last bunch of years. It's stunning what the people have to go through just to have a basic amount of what I would call respect. And I mean that on several levels, not just the management level, but the architecture, as was stated before, and the aesthetics of the environment within the architecture. It's, in some cases, very much like a lot of these countries that we try to liberate these days and allow to live what we call the freer lifestyles that we should all come to expect.
All right. Thanks for the call, Jay. What about that, Larry? He says if it's getting better, not seen here.
Well, I think it varies tremendously from place to place. One of the most striking interviews that was reported in my book was from a cable guide a few years back who was describing what he was finding in the basements of some of the housing in Boston and just how horrific the work conditions. It actually prompted a complaint about working conditions in trying to install wiring. It's gotten better in some cases and less well in others. The one that I keep pointing to that has succeeded so dramatically, the Commonwealth development in Boston, has done so in part because this respect was instilled from day one by the private management team. The residents worried a bit, you know, what kind of standards are they going to have for maintenance and turnaround of work orders and things like that. And the answer was they're going to keep to exactly the same standards that they have for their private sector middle-class communities in the suburbs. They planted the flowers that Gail mentioned earlier before even starting on the renovations, and the flowers are still very much there. They put them in a letter C, and they weren't sure at first whether it was C for the Corcoran Management Company or C for the Commonwealth Development. But it really was C for the community, as best as I can tell. It's got problems still. Residents still have lots of complaints. But the remarkable thing is 15 years after a major redevelopment, it's a safe and healthy community that doesn't have the sorts of problems that the caller described. It's possible to do something about it, but it takes great efforts by all sorts of people working in concert.
Thanks for the call, Jay. Let's go now to Steve, who's on the line from Buford, South Carolina. Hi, Steve.
Hello. How are you today?
Good, thanks. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. I had a grew up in public assisted housing when I was a youth. We had to move around quite a bit. One of the big problems that we had was the acronym that we know as NIMBY, not in my backyard. We would hear of places that were going to be developed. Communities would rise up. We don't want these people here. Almost like there was a social stigma for trying to get someone back on their feet and to help us out. And fortunately, we were able to find good housing, and my parents have done well for themselves. But it was very tough early on.
All right. Thanks for the call, Steve.
Sure.
I think that that's a fundamental issue facing public housing and public housing reform is where do people go next? Sometimes it's unaffordable for them to go much of anywhere, because if you lose your public housing subsidy, the alternative in many housing markets is to leave the city completely. And sometimes the experience of trying to take one of these vouchers that are given to try and deconcentrate public housing yields exactly the same problems with landlords that the caller is describing, and a certain unwillingness to house people even when they are very needy. And it's a tremendous problem in a city like Chicago, for instance.
One of the stories that you tell, which was very interesting, about the court-appointed receiver in the Boston case, who once said that he knew that the Commonwealth Project could be saved because people there were angry. Now, you have to wonder why it's even surprising that people would be angry. If they're living in horrific conditions, why wouldn't they be?
There's a kind of anger that is a productive one. It's a channeled anger that they had, and it's still there even now. There are people that are deeply suspicious of what's going to happen next if they let their guard down, even after a very successful redevelopment. There was a sense that anger for people in public housing who have felt victimized by the system, whether it be the bureaucracy of the housing authority or the racial politics of the city, whatever that is, to come into decades, the response is often not anger but resignation. And so that the fact of anger means someone is thinking there is a possibility for redress, and that is so much further along than the sort of person who feels that it's simply my destiny to live out my days in a horrific situation. So anger, productively channeled, is really the first part of the challenge of trying to rebuild public housing.
And in fact, that they're willing to put some energy into changing it. How important is it that the ideas for change come from the bottom up and not from the top down, that the tenants really do make their own decisions about what's going to happen where they live?
I think the best case scenario is a convergence. It cannot simply be a housing authority saying, we are now going to redevelop you and it's going to be for your own good. It has to be a sense of partnership. And in the best cases, it's a partnership among a housing authority, an empowered tenant group, and some form of management entity, whether it be a private management company or some kind of reformed public management option. And when that happens well, when the tenants really feel invested, there is a sense of psychological ownership. Even though they aren't going to own their apartments for the most part, there's a sense that they are vested in the future of the place, and that someone for the first time in a very long while, in at least this one sector of their lives, is taking them seriously.
We were speaking a few moments ago about the future of the HOPE program. Its future does seem to be in doubt. The Bush administration is not very enthusiastic about it, and in fact may be getting rid of the money for it. But it's also interesting that we're looking at the full circle here of it started out being for the quote-unquote deserving poor, and now that seems to be one of the criteria as well. You have to wonder what's going to happen to the quote-unquote undeserving poor.
Well, that's a great question. Certainly public housing, if it's to have a future at all, has to have a level of tenant selection and eviction procedures that make it possible to get rid of the most disruptive members of a community. No one thinks that you can house everyone in public housing, as was once thought to be possible in the 1960s or 70s. The question is whether you can do something that helps more of the neediest people, regardless of their employment status, regardless of their family status. But if they are law-abiding and willing to take on the rules, there ought to be a place in public housing for those people. The Hope 6 program, as it's known, was a 10-year experiment that has had nearly $5 billion spent on about 100 cities nationwide, probably close to 200 housing developments, receiving on an average of $30 to $50 million each to rehab and redevelop their worst parts or to leverage other money to do that. And it was a 10 years that has now run its course. So the question was, do you reauthorize it? And the initial response from the Bush administration was no. However, it's now being rethought yet again, as things are in Washington, because it's politically very popular among congresspeople who see this as one way that large investments are coming into distressed communities in their districts. And I don't think we've closed the book on Hope 6 yet. Maybe we'll have to name it Hope 7. I don't think anybody's going to take my alternative acronym of housing our poor people elsewhere. But until and unless we get to the point where we take that aspect of it seriously, Hope 6 is not going to be successfully reformed.
And how interesting that one of the raps against it has been they weren't spending the money fast enough.
Yeah. That certainly is a serious rap, and it's partly just because these things are complicated to pull off, but it's partly because very often you're asking a distressed public agency to turn around a distressed public housing project, and that you deal by virtue of large amounts of money coming suddenly into an agency that doesn't know how to manage and spend it very well. All sorts of problems will arise. So that rap is a serious one.
We'll have to leave it there for now. Thanks so much to my guest. Lawrence Vail is professor of urban design and planning at MIT. His most recent book is Reclaiming Public Housing, A Half Century of Struggle in Three Public Neighborhoods. Thanks, Larry.
Thank you.
Connection listeners, you can continue the conversation on our website, theconnection.org. The Connection is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Kelly Jones, Arete Karitsky-Fox, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugarts. Mark Allard is with Dick Gordon in Baghdad. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Gail Harris, and for Dick Gordon, this is The Connection.